This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're here every Saturday and we're talking about the disease of addiction and the road to recovery. Recovery Radio is sponsored, of course, by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. So if you've got some time on this busy afternoon, I hope you'll stick around and listen. We try to do a couple of things here. Not least of which is to educate people about this disease. It's much in the news now. I needn't go into the crisis situation that exists in this country with regard to the opiate addiction, for one thing. We're going to focus on a pretty specific area with regard to recovery, and that is dealing with something that is an ordinary fact of life, and that is handling stress and anxiety. We all have to do that to one extent or another. Folks in recovery are no different, but at somewhat a greater risk from the effects of stress and anxiety. To that end, we have with us from Retreat at Palm Beach, Paul Kurlanchik. Paul is a clinical specialist in West Palm Beach at Retreat, and these are the things he deals with as he helps people try to handle the disease of addiction. Paul Kurlanchik, thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Can we get a little bio about you? Tell us where you're from and how you got into this field.
Sure. I'm from Pennsylvania, and I actually started with Retreat at Lancaster in 2012. And I've always been interested in psychology and studied that in college, got my master's in that. And then for a lot of personal reasons, needed to find coping skills for myself for dealing with the world, and started dabbling with Chinese medicine and Western psychology and a whole bunch of different forms, and each one seemed to take me to yet another form that was helpful. And so in helping myself, if I found something that worked, I simply went out and studied it so I could help others with it. And that's pretty much the history of finding something that's been helpful and then learning it.
How long have you been in the field of recovery, treatment for recovery?
I've been in the world of recovery for 23 years, and I've been studying, even before then I studied psychology and had dabbled in a few classes in drug and alcohol treatment.
Paul, at the outset there, I mentioned that we all have to manage stress and anxiety. The world, I guess everybody at every point in history thought they were living in the most stressful and anxious times. So I don't mean to make that point. But clearly, someone battling the disease of addiction has an additional problem with regard to stress and anxiety. Correct?
Yes, absolutely. The best teacher I ever had on the topic of addiction told me that the root cause of addiction is pain. And stress is, anxiety is just another feature of pain and the way it's crippling someone's psyche, crippling their, hurting their immune system, hurting their physical nature, spiritual nature. It really works on all the dimensions. And getting help for that is critical for the recovering person.
Yeah. When you mentioned pain, the other thing I have heard over and over again when I talk to people who struggle with addiction and are now in recovery is that from a very early age, they talked about an emptiness, sort of a hole, something they couldn't even describe about not fitting someplace. When you say pain is the leading cause, you mean a kind of psychic pain, correct?
Yeah, psychic, emotional pain, absolutely. That what you're talking now about, that emptiness, can be traced back to what I call toxic shame. And that's the development in childhood of the belief that I'm not lovable, I'm not valuable, I'm not worthy. And I don't know if we're ready to talk a little bit about that, but
no, that's interesting because that's sort of the hallmark of not just a damaged childhood, but I mean, in one sense, the entire culture sort of tells you that you've got to prove something that you're born flawed, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if you know about John Bradshaw has written some really good works on the topic of shame and addiction, and his belief is that toxic shame is the cause of addiction, and unless that gets treated, then you know that the symptom that the addiction is really the symptom of the bigger problem, which is the toxic shame, and that starts really young. It starts pre-verbal, before kids or babies can really process thinking. All they are is vibration. You know, all they can do is pick up vibrations from what's happening in their world, and that's where that sense of emptiness starts. I mean, it's pre-verbal. It comes from a time when, you know, if there's a situation in the family where, well, basically you have to have air, water, shelter, food, and you need security. And that early, from ages 0 to 2, security is super important. And if that need for security isn't met, a lot of things happen. It doesn't allow the person to move on to the next level of development of the brain, which is that period of time when you're developing an ego and developing an identity that's separate from being just part of the, being part of the whole world. Now I'm developing a separate identity, and I'm learning to say no. And if you think about it, addicts can't say no. So that sense of dis-ease that happens really early on, if that need for security isn't met, then I've got this feeling of emptiness inside of me, and I keep trying to fill that up with anything and everything I can get my hands on.
What do we know about the origins of that? Is it something that is learned even at the early age you mentioned, or is this kind of toxic pain and shame passed along genetically? I mean, do we know anything about that?
I think, yeah, it's a combination of both. And another thing to be reminded of is that when the child is in the mother's womb, and it can be affected there, if you think about whatever the mother is going through is affecting the hypothalamus produces chemicals that go through her body for every feeling that she has. And so without wanting to be, well, I've talked to people, I've had clients who come in and said, well, my mom was afraid that she was going to miscarry. And she may have had, I'm third, she'd had 2 miscarriages before I was born. So you can imagine the amount of fear that the mother might have been going through.
Yeah. Well, there's
not
much
affecting the baby.
Sure, without a doubt. But it's also true that there's not much any of us can do with regard to prenatal conditions.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, We're stuck.
So, in your field, you're dealing with people who are the product of this problem, and
right.
In addition to which, they have to deal with, there's the stress that caused the problem, then there's the stress and anxiety that they're going through trying to regain their sobriety. And that's what I think
right.
you want to focus on here now. And
okay.
I know that among the things that you do as a clinical specialist down there is help people manage these things. Let's talk a little bit about coping skills.
Okay.
Can you just tell us what a couple of those might be?
Coping, the number one coping skill for this situation is sharing about what's going on inside. To have support of peers or have support from someone that is not going to be judgmental of you and is going to show you compassion, and to be able to, in a safe way, share what's really happening inside of you. To me, the root cause of anxiety is the inability to share what's going on. So all these feelings bottle up and bottle up and bottle up, and then the brain can't handle them anymore. And, you know, anxiety is really a short-circuiting of the brainwave patterns that just can't face another thing. You know, I've had people say to me many times, and I've seen it happen many times, where things bottle up and bottle up and bottle up, and all of a sudden, one more thing is not possible. The bottle can't hold another thing, and somebody blows up or explodes, or in some cases just relapses because that it's been too much. It's gone over the top.
I'm interested that you say sharing you think is the number one coping skill with regard to managing stress and anxiety and recovery. That, of course, probably is the central operating premise of the 12-step or the brother or the you know, the Alcoholic
Fellowship
there. Is it possible to, it's ridiculous to say this, is it possible to share outside of a group setting? Is it, I mean, can one share with oneself, I guess is what I'm saying. Can you be honest with yourself without the necessity of a group?
Well, the problem with being trying to be honest with yourself is that when I'm, or anyone is emotionally upset, if we could scan their brain at the time they're emotionally upset, what we find is that all the energy and the intention has gone to the limbic system in the front part of their, the center part of their brain. It's their emotional center. And the front part of their brain, which is where they make their good decisions and can think clearly, is shut down because it can't get to the that part of the brain. You know, the brain can only focus on one thing at a time. And if you're emotionally upset, that's going to get all the attention. And the thinking process can't, you know, it's nice to think that I could be honest with myself, and I can be when I'm clear of emotional upset. But so much of the time for an addict, their life is emotional upset is number one.
Our guest is Paul Kurlanchik. Paul is a clinical specialist at Retreat Palm Beach. He's here talking to us about dealing with stress and anxiety as part of the recovery process. Interesting topic. We're talking about coping skills. We'll pick up on that straight ahead. Paul has mentioned sharing, in his view, being the number one coping mechanism, but there are others, and I'd like to take a look at some of those when we come back. You're listening to Recovery Radio, so don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. My guest on the telephone is Paul Kurlanchik. Paul is clinical specialist at Retreat at Palm Beach. They, of course, Retreat to sponsor the program. And Paul has joined us to talk about dealing with stress and anxiety. As I said at the beginning of the program, everybody has to. It's a part of living, getting through a stressful or anxious moment or day, never more so for people who are in recovery. Paul, you also help people with managing both their pain and anxiety. Is that physical pain as well? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of people have come in, you know, in these days because they've been over-prescribed medication that's taking them down that path of opiate addiction.
In the first segment, we got into some of the coping skills. It's worth noting at this point, if we have not yet already, that the reason you deal with stress and anxiety in this critical period of fighting addiction is that it is, as I understand it, one of, if not the leading cause of relapse, right?
Absolutely.
Stress builds.
Most of the time I'm hearing from people, they're saying it was a feeling of being overwhelmed that caused them to relapse.
That's
always emotional overwhelm. It's not physical.
So like anything else you're trying to avoid, you can't wish it away. You've got to learn how to be good at this. And we're talking about some of the coping skills. We began talking about the sharing in a kind of group setting, just talking it out and understanding that you're not alone here and that these feelings are not yours uniquely. I wondered whether it was possible outside of a group setting to use techniques that would minimize or handle stress and anxiety. I was thinking of meditation. What role does that play? Because that's a solitary pursuit, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's growing. It's like mainstream compared to where it was when I first started. Mindfulness meditation and just the quieting down the mind, slowing down the activity of your brain so that it's going to influence that limbic system. It's going to influence the discord or disturbance in your mind, especially if you can set it up as a habit pattern. If you can make it something that you do often, daily or maybe twice a day, you can call upon it when you need it for upset. It's like the guy says, you don't start building the parachute when the plane starts to come down. You develop those skills.
Talk a little bit about what you just said there about meditation being something that should be almost like exercise, thought of ahead of time, done at a certain time every day. Why is that routine necessary?
It's the way the brain works best. The brain works on neural pathways that are set up for an addict, what happens is that we have all these neural pathways that are set up that have negative consequences. I see a lighter and I'm triggered. I see, all these different triggers that people have. Well, if you can create positive triggers in your brain, positive outcomes for those triggers, you can change the neural pathways, and it takes habit is what we use to create those new neural pathways. If I do the same thing over and over and over again, it's going to become a habit. It takes about, from what I read, it's 21 days to make a habit. I do something with people, it's really interesting. I tell them in the morning, wake up and think of five things you're grateful for that start with the letter A. And the next morning I'm going to ask you to think of five things you're grateful for that start with the letter B, and go through the whole alphabet. And in 26 days, you're going to start waking up having positive thoughts. I mean, it literally changes the programming of the brain, and it's a simple exercise. Mm-hmm. Well, if I sit down every day and I take a minute, just a minute, and for that minute, all I do is focus on my belly rising with each in-breath and falling with each out-breath.
That's it is one minute. It
sounds
a couple things come to mind. This is what the Grateful Dead meant by "I need a miracle every day," and yeah. Also, what you describe in this routine of meditation or mindfulness sounds a lot like what, I hate to use a trite example, a golf instructor would tell you about: if you swing the club often enough properly, your muscle will remember how to do that. So is that what we're talking about, reprogramming the brain, sort of a muscle brain, to change
Absolutely.
The way you think?
Yeah. Yeah. How I want to start out my day. I think, you know, if I want to start out with my day, I want to have the most success possible for each day. So if I start out with calming my mind down mm-hmm. and teaching it to, we'll get into it later, I guess, but there's so many different ways you can do that. You can do that in Walmart. You don't have to be sitting in the mountains in a cave with a blanket wrapped around you. You can literally be in the checkout line.
Can you do it? Because it seems to me, well, let me ask you a question, because I don't think this has ever come up. With regard to quieting down the mind and lowering stress and anxiety so that recovery, you have a greater possibility to recover from the disease of addiction, we live in a very noisy society. What's the role that all social media, all the multiple screens we have, all the competing voices, that can't make it any easier?
No, there's too many distractions, so many distractions that can take you away. I don't know if you've ever noticed when you sit down and watch television, it's almost like hypnotic, and it feels like it's difficult to get out of the chair because you're so engrossed in what's happening, or you get stuck there. And pathways.
I've seen it in my grandchild's face when the screen comes on. They almost go into some like a trance-like state. What is the situation in recovery for somebody with regard to things like cell phones and video games and social media and all of that stuff? What's the rule of thumb at retreat?
While they're at retreat?
Yes, recovery.
While they're in recovery, it would be too much of a distraction. It would, the focus has to be, again, we're trying to create brain surgery, literally, and changing the neural pathways in the first 30 days so that they can, develop some track, a much healthier track. We've got to do some radical, make some radical changes in what their everyday life is. And, so there's some time for relaxation here, but to be, it's just too easy to be distracted. It's too easy for an addict to be distracted.
Dealing with stress and anxiety as part of the process of recovery. That's the topic today on Recovery Radio. We have more. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano is my name. I'm here on Saturday. We talk about the disease of addiction. Most importantly, we want to tell you about the road to recovery. All the news about the opiate epidemic is real and devastating and scary as all get out. There is another side to what's going on with addiction in this country. It is lesser well known, but important nevertheless. And that is that millions, literally millions of people right now are living in long-term successful sobriety. Didn't happen accidentally. They worked at it. They got the help they needed. When we decided to do this program, and Peter Shore, the CEO and founder of Retreat, sponsored it, he said, look, we have a world-class organization. We can provide lots of help for lots of people. And you should remind folks of that. But the program is about informing people. So any questions or comments about anything you have regarding the disease of addiction, you can call Retreat and they will answer those questions for you. If their treatment centers are what you're looking for, then you will not be in better hands. So here's the phone number. And here's the other thing we'd like to remind you. We hope you never have to use this number. 855-859-8808. That's 855-859-8808, Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. From their West Palm Beach facility, clinical specialist Paul Kurlanchik has been with us. We've been talking about dealing with stress and anxiety, critical components to overcome or manage when trying to get sober, since stress can very often trigger a relapse. Paul, take a minute and talk about some of these techniques, because when people who have not practiced them or had this disease in their lives hear about, well, you can walk or you can exercise or you can have a mantra and meditate your way to health, I think they tend to dismiss this. Why do these things work, these techniques?
That's really a good question, and I'm reminded that some of the medical programs themselves have taken meditation and use it for pain management, and found success with it. I think that's the key, is that for some reason, when the brain is relaxed and calm, it makes sense. I mean, if I slow down the activity of my brain, and let's say I have pain, physical pain, well, I'm slowing down the pain center of the brain that recognizes that I have pain. I'm slowing down the activity of my nervous system that brings the message to my brain that there's something wrong, that there's some pain coming to me for some reason. Part of the recovery process around that also can be hypnosis, which is really just a different form of meditation. Instead of someone doing hypnosis on you, you're kind of hypnotizing yourself. You're using meditation to place your mind in a very relaxed state so that you can slow down the activity, you can change the feelings in your body, you can change the level of distress that you might be feeling. I mean, these are all things that are being experienced.
What's the difference between meditation and another, it's almost a buzzword at this point, mindfulness? What's the difference between, first of all, what is mindfulness?
Mindfulness is a form of meditation. It fits under the umbrella of meditation. Mindfulness might be wherever you are, whatever you're doing right now, if you were to focus all of your attention on the left arm, let's say, from the forearm, the left forearm, like mine's resting on a table right now, so I can feel the table touching my the left forearm. And this all sounds trite and silly, but if I bring my attention, the definition for meditation is concentration combined with relaxation. If I can bring my mind to something and relax while I'm doing it and keep that as my focus of attention, there is no stress that can get into my mind. It can't come in. The brain can only process one thing at a time.
So that's why the cliched view of meditation is this dark room with a candle.
Right. If I'm focused on sitting and looking at that candle, that's all that's in my mind. Now, the brain will, you know, interject thoughts. And so there's even meditations to deal with that. I mean, there's some meditations. There's one that I use and show people. You can imagine you're sitting by a stream and you're sitting in a very comfortable place, and every occasionally down the stream will float a leaf, and you'll watch that leaf in your mind's eye, and you'll watch the leaf go down and go around a bend and disappear. Well, that leaf is like a thought. Just let every thought that you're having be that leaf that's flowing down the stream. And so we're not asking you to stop your thoughts. I mean, that's what people mostly think about meditation.
Is that it's somewhere right.
Quietly.
Mm-hmm. And think of nothing.
Think of nothing. Well,
which is
if
impossible.
I tell you to think of nothing, you're going to be thinking about thinking of nothing. It can't work.
let me ask you with regard to the therapeutic session at a place like Retreat, for instance. Is mm-hmm. there a time set aside for the patients to, you know, be quiet and be alone? Is that part Is that up to them to organize, or is it structured into the treatment?
No, we structure it into the treatment. There's opportunities throughout the day. There's a morning, half 30 minutes in the morning. There's at least an hour in the afternoon. Some afternoons there's two different one-hour sessions. One is all related to what we're talking about, all different forms of you know, moving meditations are also important. A lot of people can't sit still. I mean, if you think about it, somebody comes in and they're highly anxious, and I ask them to sit still, they're going to be, that's the last
thing. You're going to cause stress.
Yeah, it's going to cause them stress. So for those people, I'll do a moving meditations, like we'll do something from yoga, or the Chinese version of it is Qigong, where we'll do some simple movements. And again, it's meditation because I'm concentrating on what I'm doing and I'm relaxing at what I'm doing. And that's really enlightening for a lot of people, that they don't have to sit still and they don't have to throw their legs over their,
Yeah, they don't have to sit in a lotus position.
And I've never been able to sit in a lotus position. Most of the people I know can.
Right. Let's pivot here from the techniques that are available to manage stress and anxiety in the context of getting sober, and talk about, you know, why it's important. Now, we've mentioned that stress is a major trigger for relapse, so that's fairly obvious, but there are other, there are physical and there are emotional and mental, a mental price to pay if you can't manage stress, correct?
Absolutely.
What have you seen that in your patients with regard to, you know, difficulty in handling is the physical aspects or the emotional aspect?
Well, you know, the day-to-day life for an addict is one of making critical decisions throughout the day. The biggest one is not to use. And when the person is again upset and there is no critical thinking, there's no their habit patterns are one where it's act, it's fire ready aim. It's what we live with, addicts live by. First we shoot and then we think about it, mm-hmm. and then we make a decision. That's not going to work. So if again we can give them a program where they can take time, maybe a few times a day, just to take a minute at a time and slow down their thinking. There's a much better likelihood they're going to be able to use the frontal lobe of the brain. They're going to have a much better opportunity for them to make good decisions, to make healthy decisions. And that's just on the mental level. On the physical level and emotional level and spiritual level, there's much bigger ramifications to stress and what happens to the immune system. So many diseases today that weren't even around when we were kids, when I was a kid anyway, are now autoimmune deficiency issues.
Yeah. Is the problem, in this part of the world, I think these techniques are obviously foreign and exotic. In the East, they are far more common and better understood, I guess, than utilized. Is part of the problem in the West, and I don't want to get too global about this, but that when you talk about the disease of addiction and then managing stress and anxiety, we live in a culture where if you have garden variety stress and anxiety in your life, you can go take a pill for it.
Right.
That's part of the problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. And some of the addiction we're dealing with now is coming from that. It's not all opiates anymore.
No, how dangerous are things like benzodiazepine?
Oh, very addictive, extremely addictive. And unfortunately, the withdrawal from them is horrible. It can be very long-term.
Some of the benzodiazepines that people might be familiar with are?
Valium was the old-fashioned one, but now it's Xanax and Klonopin and Ativan.
And these can be habit-forming.
Absolutely. They're not habit-forming and very difficult to withdraw from. Very difficult and long. It's a long process. And people are just not aware. I don't think doctors are informing them that they're not aware of how habit-forming they are. And even if you're taking them as prescribed, it's not like you have to overdose on them. I mean, it's not like you're cheating on your prescription. If you're doing, whatever is prescribed is habit-forming.
This is what we saw the effects of graphically with the Tiger Woods, and a lot of people. I was surprised to hear say, "Well, at least he wasn't drinking," and you look at him in some of those videos, and you go, "He couldn't possibly be in worse shape." And he claims it was not, and we don't know because the toxicology report is not in, but he claims it was less a question of opioid, but a combination of opioid and the benzodiazepines he was on. But, right. but he certainly is in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he's in he's in rehab even as we speak now. So you know, I mean, the kind of way we live is a producer of stress and anxiety. We all know that, which for most people can lead to just some miserable days, and for people with a real problem can lead and exacerbate their addiction. And we're talking about that stress and anxiety, how important it is to manage that as you regain your sobriety in recovery, because for a number of reasons, if you can't, you're not going to be very successful in your recovery. This is Recovery Radio. We're talking to Paul Kurlancic, who is clinical specialist at Retreat West Palm Beach. We have more with Paul. Stay with us. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Saturdays, you'll find us here talking about the disease of addiction. Recovery Radio, sponsored by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Let me give you the phone number again. Any questions or comments about what they provide in a range of just world-class facilities and therapies, or any question you have about the treatment you're getting now, they'll answer it for you. 855-859-8808. That's the phone number for Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. 855-859-8808. Let me do that again. 855-859-8808. As again, from their West Palm facility, Paul Kurlancic has been with us talking about among the things he does as a clinician in dealing with people in recovery is help them manage both their pain and their stress and anxiety levels, all critical components in a successful recovery. You know, when people start to talk about meditation or mindfulness, the specter of not so much organized religion comes up, but certainly God and spirituality come up. Can you deal a little bit with that and talk about the role of spirituality in this entire process of recovery, but also stress and anxiety, and how people who have a sort of an attitude about that need to be, you know, talked to?
Yeah, well, let's go back to where we started from the beginning. It's kind of like going to take us right around in a circle. We talked about insecurity playing a large role, insecurity being a very large role in the cause of anxiety. I'm on this planet, I've got lots of responsibilities, I've got all kinds of stress coming from employers and relationships and whatever, and I'm not clear as to what my role is and how I'm supposed to handle things. And then you have this spiritual aspect that can play a positive role in your recovery, by giving you some security, by giving you a sense that you're not alone, that there is a connection with something greater than yourself. And at the same time, no one's telling you what religion that you need to do this with, or, you know, no one's going to question what your religion of choice is, when you know, from your childhood or the one you've chosen now.
Paul, when you mention a connection to something greater than yourself, 9 times out of 10, somebody's going to go, "You mean God?"
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, what if you don't believe in God?
Well, in this case, you get to choose what could be your God, and that's really important to me. You know, when I'm talking about this with anyone, I'm giving them huge leeway. You know, there's people from the Christian tradition, and it doesn't matter whether it's the Christian or it's Christ or Buddha or Moses or Muhammad or whatever. It could be, for some people, it's just they're more interested in quantum physics at this point and talking about the source of all the energy of the universe, or the source of, the one that they might call the divine, and have no more definition of it than that. It really doesn't matter what you define it as. It really just matters, in a lot of cases, that you have something that you can turn to. And, you know, there's even traditions that I mean, if you get involved in the Zen tradition, that really gets complicated because their no-thing is everything. So, I mean, there's a lot of leeway. There's no prescription for what you're... What is God or what is this thing?
If it exists
or doesn't exist.
I think I understand that. Clearly, atheists can get sober and do.
Absolutely.
But breaking down the resistance to these notions is your job, isn't it? Part of your job.
Yeah, it's part of the job. But the thing that most people feel when they're doing the meditation is they get peace of mind. And that's the critical piece is, you know, when someone can experience peace of mind, when you can say, well, that's because of your spiritual connection or you just learned this technique that has slowed down the activity of your brain, given you a huge respite from your stress and anxiety. And that peace of mind can be your higher power.
So
because you're going to be able to think clearer and make better decisions.
So practice the techniques, observe the benefits,
right,
and I guess in one sense, don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
Right. And if in the process you have some kind of spiritual connection, great. And if you don't, well, it doesn't really matter. You've slowed down the activity of your brain so that you can feel relaxed and comfortable. You can stop the anxiety. You know, to me, it's like the on cars, there's always a red line on the speedometer. And if you go past that red line, you're going to blow your engine. Well, we each have within us our own personal red line, and it's the one of how much stress we can handle. And if I live at that level where it only takes a small blip for me to hit that red line and I'm out of control, I'm in trouble. But if I can, through meditation and however I meditate, I can slow down that activity and I can lower the level at where I live so it's a much farther, I have a lot of room between where I am and that red line. The farther down I go and the farther, more relaxed I get, I have a lot of leeway there before I'm going to blow.
Yep.
That's critical.
Yep. Paul Kurlancic from West Palm Beach Retreat, clinical supervisor. This has been great. I'd love to have you back another time to continue talking about these coping skills regarding stress and anxiety. I appreciate your time, Paul. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Everybody, enjoy the rest of your weekend. Look for us every Saturday right here, Recovery Radio. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.